Okay, so what do two John Hughes movies and A Case of Mistaken Identity have in common? I don't know either, but if you listen for the next 30 or so minutes on the DVD marquee, you just might find out. Hey, come on in. Join Stan Williams and me. It's a party.
Hi.
Hi. What do you want?
Well, I wanted to know if maybe you wanted to go out with me. But if it's too difficult a time, then I understand it.
Oh, you're asking me out on a date?
I think the first one that I want to cover here, Stan, is Some Kind of Wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
If you could relive the plot line of that film for me right quick, because I don't feel like doing all the talking this time.
Okay. Okay. The plot line of Some Kind of Wonderful. Okay. Basically, take the plot line of Pretty in Pink
right.
and switch all the guys with girls, and you got Some Kind of Wonderful.
And this was the first role for Eric Stoltz after Mask, I mm-hmm. believe it or not. And we mm-hmm. actually got to see that he was, you know, a pretty decent looking guy.
And after being fired from Back to the Future.
And after, of course.
Long before the MPAA made it a requirement that he appear in every single independent film ever made.
Pretty much. Yeah, you're right. It's basically Pretty in Pink from the male perspective. But I have to say that it just didn't grab me emotionally as the first film did. And I appreciated the fact that he wanted to do something different stylistically and not repeat himself.
What are you talking about? He very much repeats himself from Pretty in Pink.
You think so?
I think so. Look, they're both pretty much the same movie. They're both about class, you know, the poor boy or a girl likes
right.
the rich boy or a girl, and therein lies the conflict. That's what each movie is about.
I can kind of see your point, because whereas Molly Ringwald's character was a fashion designer, Eric Stoltz was a painter, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he was kind of a dork and everything like that. I think Molly Ringwald was fortunate enough not to have a very annoying kid sister like Eric Stoltz is saddled with in this film.
See?
But I guess you're right, yeah.
Okay, first off, I like the sister in Some Kind of Wonderful way more than I like Ducky in Pretty in Pink. I find her way...
Oh, really?
I find her way less annoying.
Okay, we'll have to get into that in just a second,
on. She seemed more like a real little sister to me than Ducky seemed like a real person. Ducky, to me, the character kind of went to 11 when maybe they should have stopped at around 7
okay.
or so.
But let's stay on course. Let's stay on course with
okay.
this movie.
Okay.
But go on.
I'm of the club that prefers Some Kind of Wonderful to Pretty in Pink. A lot of that has to do with I was a senior in high school when this movie came out. You know, it's the nostalgia factor. I was the target audience, you know, for most of these John Hughes movies.
Now, who wasn't? You know, who wasn't?
And, well, people who were like in their 40s or 50s, perhaps. I mean, it was, you
yeah,
know,
okay.
it was mainly targeted at high school kids. It's not a great movie. I don't think either one of them really is that good of a movie. But for me, Some Kind of Wonderful, I don't know, wins out, because I don't think it has to do anything with the fact that it's more from the male perspective. I think the characters are better. I don't think either movie really is all that solid, really, but each one has a lot of good characters and a lot of good scenes that everybody remembers. And for me, the scenes that I remember in Some Kind of Wonderful just click a little more than the scenes I remember from Pretty in Pink. And it's for me, it's the characters. I love Mary Stuart Masterson.
She is great.
I watching it now, I think I loved her. I fell in love with her even more than I did when I was 18. And Elias Koteas as the skinhead. That's just a classic character. I love that guy.
I did enjoy him, I have to say.
I love when Eric Stoltz goes into detention and the guy with the sunglasses and the long hair and his nostrils are just doing that little flare. And it's just things like that. And it's the music cues. And that's all it is. I mean, it's little moments like that. John Ashton seeing the daughter in the classroom and knocking on the door and her screaming, which is totally overboard and totally unrealistic. But damn, it makes me laugh every time I see it.
You know, I'm not immune to going back and watching it again because, you know, some days, you know, you're just not meant to see a film the way that maybe it's supposed to hit you. And it could have been the case for me. So I think you have me convinced that maybe I need to give it a second look.
But even when I was 18 and I saw this for the first time, I thought it was a bit much. You
right.
know, the whole, oh my God, I don't have money and they have money. And I'm sure... And I guess it's because of the type of high school I went to. And I'm sure, you know, that was a, you know, that sort of class system was a problem for a lot of people. In my high school, it wasn't that big of a problem. Everybody was pretty much on the same level.
Right.
So that to me always seemed like a bit much. But at the same time, these are movies about teenagers. And when you're a teenager, everything is sort of overblown. You know, everything is sort of dramatic. So I don't know. I think they work on that level.
Compare these teenage movies to the teenage movies we're getting now. I mean, I think John Hughes had his pulse on teenagers for what they really were. I mean, can you count the number of American Pie ripoffs that we've had in the last 6 years? Mm-hmm. And nothing against that film. I love that film myself. But just, you know, there was hardly any realism
today.
Well,
I guess that is the thing about Hughes, is because they were kind of a heightened realism, because nobody really went to this high school that you always saw in the John Hughes movie, but that's the high school you wanted to go to. You know, that's the one, it's the high school you kind of look back and wish, you know, maybe when you look at it through rose-colored glasses, you know, maybe that's the high, you know, you think that is the high school you went to.
Well, in a way, I think it was the high school that I went to, but at the same time, it wasn't nearly as elaborate or filled with, you know, over-the-top characters. But, you know, as far as part of it, oh, God, yeah, I went through that, too. Nailed it. He nailed it in every one of these movies.
Most of the people I went to school with didn't have writers as good as John Hughes, so the dialogue was nowhere near as good.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, let's wrap up talking about Some Kind of Wonderful with... let's go ahead and cover the features on Some Kind of Wonder before we tackle Pretty in Pink. The name Howard Deutsch, I just knew that from somewhere, and it turns out that he and Leah Thompson met on the set of this film. By the way, she's great in it as well, and they actually wound up getting married.
Yeah, they do the commentary track, which I listened to, and it was a bit like, nothing against them, they seem really nice, but it was kind of like spending a nice boring evening at the home of... at the home of Howie Deutsch and Leah Thompson, because it's a lot of him saying, yeah, we did this here and this here, and her kind of giggling at what's going on. It's great, but it's nice. It's kind of charming in a way as they kind of look back. It's fun. I find it kind of funny, though, like in all the extras, and it's kind of, really the extras here and with Pretty in Pink are pretty similar. I find it funny how it seems like every 3 minutes, God bless him, he's talking about, well, we were doing this scene and I had to call up John because I just didn't understand it. or I just didn't think this. And then John had to tell me this, which gets me to, where the hell is John Hughes?
That's a good question. You know, I was reading in Entertainment Weekly that he's, I don't know, maybe somewhere outside Chicago, and he supposedly has a lot of scripts in the can, but just, you know, where are you, John Hughes? You know, like I said a few minutes ago, you know, teenage movies are, you know, for the most part, horrible nowadays. I think we could use somebody with a bit of perspective who knows kids and writes for teenagers very, very well. Or perhaps maybe these same characters 20 years later, like our age, which I think would be fantastic.
That's what I was going to say. I think maybe somebody else should take on the mantle of writing the teen movie. But what's always disappointed me was I hope John Hughes would be there kind of for every decade of my life. John Hughes right now should be making movies about people in their late 30s or their early 40s. And I looked forward to that, you know, to that progression. He did do these movies, and then he kind of moved on to She's Having a Baby, which kind of, you know...
Oh, great movie.
Kind of goes into adulthood, and then all of a sudden, you know, apparently he becomes a dad and starts making Home Alone and all that sort of thing.
Right.
Which kind of gets back to my theory that I think anybody who's a good filmmaker should never, ever have kids. Because look what happens to them.
I don't know how to follow that, I guess I will.
Well, because you can see it. You can see it in Spielberg, even, and you can see them being creative and taking risks, and you can tell the moment that they become parents because they start holding back, and the lessons get a little more heavy-handed, you know. And I mean, I respect them for that on a, you know, from a parenting point of view, but from a filmgoer's point of view, it's like, guys, stop.
There's a trio of short little mini documentaries here. You've got The Making of Some Kind of Wonderful, and I found it fascinating that Eriot Stoltz apparently got into some kind of conflict with Deutsch, and I thought it was interesting to see how candid he was about that.
Yeah, he almost seems a little embarrassed by it. I remember Stoltz having that reputation, though, having a reputation for being difficult, but... There was more here bonus-wise than I would expect from a movie like this. There are a lot of featurettes, and you see there's a lot of modern-day interviews, kind of interspersed with interviews from when they made the movie, but I think it works.
You got the Meet the Cast featurette, 5 minute, the music, which I think is a very underrated aspect of John Hughes's filmography, because the man knows how to incorporate music.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. The one complaint I do have about the disc, and I guess it's a small thing, is that there's no trailer. Because they even talk about the trailer. I won't give away the story, but there's a scene where the girl who played the sister is talking about how she got the role, and there's a story involving the trailer that I thought was a nice little story, and they actually show clips from the trailer, but not the actual trailer. I don't understand it. Anytime there's a special edition, the first extra should be the trailer. It should be a mm-hmm. no-brainer.
That seems to be a very bad habit that is all too prevalent on a lot of Paramount discs, not just special editions, but, you know, regular releases. And, you know, there needs to be a rule established that every home video release of any given film must have the trailer included, or it's not the official release of the film. I'll put it that way. But you mentioned the absence of John Hughes. I was tickled to see a full-length interview with the man conducted with... of all people, Kevin Bacon.
Mm-hmm. Very obviously recorded around the time of She's Having a Baby.
Right, right. And it just seems to be a nice little, you know, overview of his career. But like you, I kind of, you know, wonder, you know, where the man is and why he isn't involved more fully with these releases, because they're all really well done, especially Pretty in Pink, which we're going to cover here in just a second. But... you know, in spite of the fact that I thought the movie was so-so, I still think it's a good disc. The picture quality is very well done. It's a little grainy, but...
About what you'd expect for a movie like this from 1987.
Of course, of course. But the sound, you know, considering, you know, it's a very music-heavy film, it's just fantastic. I mean, it just filled out the whole room. Mm. You can understand the dialogue really clearly. And, you know, for those that have already picked up the first one and feel, oh, man, they're ripping me off again, just, you know, give the original to somebody, you know, eBay it. But I think it's, you know, well worth picking up for fans of the film, regardless of my feelings.
And is it me, or was this lacking a stupid subtitle? You know, Pretty in Pink is the Everything's Ducky edition. Was this some kind of wonderful, the Everything's Coming Up Stoltz
wonderful
edition?
I don't know. It's interesting how one has an enhanced title and one doesn't. But regardless, I think the people who are devoted to this film, you know, you need to pick it up one more time.
I admire you.
If you wish.
Okay, Williams, I've got the gloves off right here for Pretty in Pink, and tell me why this didn't strike you the same way it did hundreds of us romantics back in 1985, 86, whatever.
Just didn't do it for me.
Really?
Really. I mean, it's okay. I mean, it's not bad at all. I have a fondness for it, too. As a movie, it just doesn't do it for me. It just seems kind of lifeless. I mean, there's a couple of good scenes here and there, some good music and everything, some good characters, but for me, it just doesn't all gel into something I necessarily want to watch again.
And I think you and I have a major difference of opinion with John Cryer here, who I think is fantastic in this movie.
I wanted to slap him after about 2 minutes. I mean, I know, I understand what they're going for. I understand right. The character that they're going for, but after a while, I was like, okay, enough. You know, I know he's the kind of annoying best friend and everything, but after a while, it just kind of grates on my nerves.
But the thing is, I related to his character so much because...
Well, you see, the thing is, you get on my nerves too.
Speak for yourself. I think I am this guy in a way. I think that, you know, maybe not to the extremes of where, you know, I danced for my friends, you know, singing Try a Little, or lip-syncing to the song Try a Little Tenderness, you know, at his age. You know, I wasn't really that developed at that point in time. But now, you know, given the years I've embraced my, you know, so-called eccentric personality and not afraid to do something like that. And that's what I loved about this character. He is who he is. And I just think it's probably, I don't know if it was his first film, but just I think it's a heck of a performance, because I've always been a big John Cryer fan. He just seems to be, you know, one of the genuinely nice, regular guys out there.
Mm-hmm.
But you're still not convinced, right?
I like John Cryer fine. I do. And he's fine as the character. It's just
right.
And there's something about the way Molly Ringwald is such a bitch to him that I watch that and I just kind of, and I mean, I like him too, but I mean, and honestly,
like her too.
I guess I do in a weird way like his character, in that I kind of look at it and just want to go, dude, you can do better. Because there's a moment where You know, the scene everybody remembers where Ducky comes into the record store and is dancing, you know, lip syncing to...
It's just a classic piece
try,
of work.
To try a little tenderness. It's okay. But, no, it is a classic. But
it's great.
There's a part where he's walking by the counter and Molly Ringwald just gives him a look of utter disgust. And that bothers me.
Like, I gave you an utter look of disgust a minute ago when you said I was getting on your nerves.
I'm just saying...
Funny boy.
I'm just saying you go to 11 and 7 will be good.
Let's talk about Andrew McCarthy and Molly Ringwald. Great chemistry. I've always thought that Andrew McCarthy was one of the most underrated actors of the 80s. And unlike most rich guys in a movie, he's a really charming fella. I mean, just you're kind of rooting for, you know, the consensus. Most people were kind of rooting for Ducky to wind up with Molly Ringwald's character. But you know, I was rooting for Andrew McCarthy the whole way.
Oh, Ducky was like way better off with Annie Potts.
Oh, definitely. And let's talk about Annie Potts. Hubba. How great is she in this film?
She's awesome in it. I'd like to see a movie just with her character.
Exactly. I mean, just what a breakout role for her. And she's always been one of my favorites from Ghostbusters onward. Well, I hate to disagree, but just I think it's probably one of the best teen. Oh, okay, well, you get out here, okay? This is my studio.
All right.
But okay, it's our first fight. The honeymoon had to end sometime, folks. I think it's not only one of the best teen comedies of all time, but one of the best romance films of all time. I mean, it just really affected me in that way.
Real quick.
It's a Cinderella story at heart. You got to admit that.
Okay, as a comedy, just real quick, aside from Ducky lip syncing in the record store, name a funny moment in the movie now. That's my point.
Anytime that Molly Ringwald rolls her eyes at whatever Ducky's doing, and every time Annie Potts changes her hairstyle, funny moment. But you got to remember, it's a balance. It's not only a comedy, but it's a drama. And it's more, at times, a drama than it is a comedy. It blends both of them
I know. It's kind of like, the whole movie is just kind of like sitting around waiting for the prom to finally get here.
Yeah, true. I mean, you know, that's the big event, you know. I mean, every movie's got to have a big climactic scene. Just like every romance, I mean, we've seen it in everything from, you know, Gone with the Wind to When Harry Met Sally. I mean, there's going to be either something that's just going to bring the characters together or drive them apart. We're all waiting for it, of course, but I think everything between the opening titles and the big moment did it for me. Now, for those of you, again, like Some Kind of Wonderful, this is another double dip to replace your bare bone release. And we thought that Some Kind of Wonderful was jam-packed. I thought this disc bordered on slight overkill with the extras. But let me tell you what, I'd rather have a lot more than nothing at all.
Exactly. That's the best complaint you can have about a disc like this. You're absolutely right. I thought Some Kind of Wonderful. I thought they covered a lot more than I was expecting. And, you know, getting into the extras here, I learned way more than I ever really needed to know about Pretty in Pink.
Yeah, we learned everything from Andrew McCarthy standing up Molly Ringwald on a real life date to, I'll tell you, I wish they had left out the weird story because I'm never going to look at the prom scene the same way again. Minor spoiler, if you want to leave the extras as a surprise, so you may want to cut us down here for about a minute, but they reshot the ending. The original ending had Ducky ending up with our heroine, and a lot of people said, nope, we don't like it. We'd like Andrew McCarthy to be the good guy or the one that she winds up with, which is the way it was originally written. So 6 months later, Andrew McCarthy's got like a crew cut or something, and they have designed this really bad wig that John Cryer said made Andrew look like a mushroom. Now tell me the man's not funny.
I know I sound like I hate it, which I don't. I don't. I just don't think it's quite the classic everybody it seems to have been built up as. But yeah, it's an awesome disc, and I would highly recommend it for anybody who's a fan of the movie. Hell, even if you're not a fan of the movie, it's still kind of interesting just from a...
Well, nostalgia. You know, it's funny. It's in a way, it's bittersweet because now we look at it as a period piece. But back then, it meant something. And I think to those of us that did experience it the first time, it still means something. And that's why I'm so glad that they went over the hill in terms of doing this. I lost count of the featurettes, but basically they're all under the title of Back to the Prom, I think it was, or something like that. Anyway, you have like a making of the film, a feature on the music, You learn that Jennifer Beals from Flashdance fame was originally considered for this part. Man, what a train wreck that would have been. I mean, no offense to Jennifer Beals. But
Gina Gershon's favorite or first role, I believe.
Really? I did not see her.
Really?
Holy Toledo. I'm going to watch it again. And Harry Dean Stanton, I mean, what a brilliant actor he was. It's just one of my favorite characters in the John Hughes movie ever. Mm-hmm. And we learned that Molly hung out with Harry between takes, and they developed quite a really nice friendship, which transferred to the screen. We've also got a commentary track with director Howard Deutsch. And,
in which we learned on this movie also, he had to call John Hughes a lot to figure out what was going on.
And they didn't have cell phones at the time, so it was fun. Well, I can't remember if they had cell phones. I don't think they did, but just...
So I called him up, and I'm like, John, I don't understand what's going on in this scene. And John told me, he's like, look, Howie, we're going to use this music. It'll work. And it worked. You get a lot of that.
But just... He's so self-effacing. He's a very charming guy. And this was his first film. I would have been in the same situation, too. I would have been, like, indecisive and, you know, mommy, which, you know, evidently was on this film.
I am curious, though, to learn why, and this is something I noticed back in the late 80s, why John Hughes would rewrite his own movies.
Right.
Because, as we talked about, you have Pretty in Pink, and then the next year... Some Kind of Wonderful.
Right.
Then I think in 87, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, which Hughes, I believe, wrote and directed. And then the next year, there was The Great Outdoors, which I think is similar thematically. And once again, written by John Hughes, but directed by Howard Deutsch. So it seemed to me like for a while, it's like Howard Deutsch's career was pretty much... remaking the movie that John Hughes made the year before.
That's an interesting piece of knowledge you bring to the table here. For people that bought the original, oh, by far, you know, trash it, smash it, give it away, whatever.
And I will say this, although it does sound like I probably hated the movie, I don't. And I actually wouldn't mind owning this disc.
They picked up the wrong guy.
Wrong guy for what?
Whatever it is you want to see me about.
Do you know what I want to see you about?
No.
Then how do you know I have the wrong guy?
Then right across the street lives this other crime boss they call the rabbi.
Why do they call him the rabbi?
Because he's a rabbi.
But I'm not Nick Fisher.
And who the hell are you?
I'm Slevin.
That's not Nick Fisher.
I know.
He set you up. You should run.
I can't.
They'll kill you if you stay.
They'll kill me if I leave.
Time's up.
Now, for those of you that listen to the show on a regular basis, we tend to save the best for last. Not this time, folks. Our final film, and regrettably our final film, or perhaps, fortunately, our final film from March of this year, Lucky Number 11. Promising cast, promising premise, and I think about the only thing that I took out of this movie in a positive way was taking it out of the DVD player. I have to admit, I swear to you that I don't think I have had such a negative reaction to a film since, and I don't know if I shared this with you, Stan, but I went to see a movie called What Lies Beneath, directed by Robert Zemeckis. You heard of it?
Yeah, I remember you hated it. I never saw it.
Please don't. I'm the kind of person, you know, I'm not easily entertained, but I like to think of myself as a very positive guy for the most part, and something that maybe doesn't turn out the way I want it to, I try and take some kind of positive aspect out of it. But when I went to see What Lies Beneath, I was so pissed off that I couldn't go through the lobby, and as I started to go out the exit door of the screen, I almost wanted to pull I can't remember what team or player it was, but I remember somebody spitting at the umpire in a big championship game a few years ago, World Series or League Championship, and I wanted to literally spit at the screen. That's how mad I was. I don't even know where to start. The dialogue is awful. Josh Hartnett, why is he in show business? Because no offense, and just he seems like a decent guy and all that, but just... My gosh, I mean, he's almost like freaking wallpaper in this movie. He's done a couple of decent performances, 40 Days and 40 Nights, and Pearl Harbor, but just he just doesn't do it for me.
I have thought for years, why would anybody, okay, you're making a movie. Okay, somebody goes through the trouble of writing it. You go through the trouble of, you know, renting lights, getting a director, getting a crew, getting actors, putting money in it. All of this work, why would anybody, after all that work, put Josh Hartnett in front of a camera.
Right. It's I really don't know what else to say. I've got some more notes here,
I have one more thing to say.
Okay.
He has no eyes. It's like he seriously doesn't have eyes. They never open. I swear the man has nothing but four eyebrows.
Right.
It's two eyebrows with two other eyebrows underneath.
And, you know, in addition to that, and Josh, please don't take this personally. It's just that, you know, get out of the business, especially after hearing about the Blue Dahlia, which we'll probably get into in about 6 months from now.
A Black Dahlia.
Okay. See, it's so bad I've forgotten the color. But Hartnett, for one thing, is still too young for this kind of role. He brought no kind of authority or charm or believability to it. I think even somebody like Matthew McConaughey would have been better in this.
You can take a dictionary. Okay.
Yeah.
Look up any word that is described as a noun. Okay. Take any of these words in the dictionary described as nouns. Object that word references will have more charisma than Josh Hartnett. Let's try it, okay? Let's just look around the room and see everything that has more charisma than Josh Hartnett, okay?
the shadow of my chandelier thing, yeah.
Basket, carpet cleaner, cup, DVD slipcase.
Bottle of wine that was given to me about 4 years ago.
Half drink Diet Pepsi. All of these, I think, have more natural charisma than Josh Hartnett in front of a camera.
So you're saying that an evening would be better spent with the Schoolhouse Rock in this movie?
That said, that's what I have thought for a long time. That said, I do, as much as I hate to admit it, because I so dread seeing him in anything, I actually didn't think he was as bad in this as he has been in all the other stuff I've seen him in.
You think the man has a potential growth factor?
Well, if he has a potential growth, he may want to get that checked.
Yeah, Stan, I just don't know. No, I just don't know. I was bored.
I don't want to slam the guy, but no.
And I don't want to either.
I'm just saying he was moderately better in this than I've seen him in other stuff, which by no means means it was good. For the movie it was, I don't know, it's a very strange movie because this, and to be honest with you, I liked it more than I thought it was going to. The problem with this movie, and it's so evident in the title, Lucky Number 11. That's a very clumsy way of trying to be clever.
Right.
And
it was so clumsy they had to change it for the home video title because they added the little numerical symbol rather than number. People are just going to get this now. They're going to grab it. They're going to rent it. But anyway, go ahead.
Well, plus they have, you know, the horribly photoshopped picture of Josh Hartnett and his four eyebrows.
Right.
But that's sort of what's problematic with the entire movie is it's trying to be clever in a very clumsy manner.
It's trying to be Tarantino, and nobody can do Tarantino but Tarantino.
Right.
I will say that I thought there were a few clever directorial touches. I think the director has a future in film if he can wipe this off his resume.
Okay, I gotta ask you one thing. What about your heterosexual man love for Bruce Willis?
Okay, I have to say, honestly, I thought Bruce Willis and Lucy Liu were the only two things in this movie that worked for me. And that's sad because you've got, you know, Morgan Freeman and Ben Kingsley. Sir Ben Kingsley, who is forced to deliver one of the worst lines in the history of mankind at 38 minutes into this film, and we're going to play it right now.
The first time somebody calls you a horse, you punch him on the nose. The second time somebody calls you a horse, you call him a jerk. But the third time somebody calls you a horse, well, then perhaps it's time to go shopping for a saddle.
Okay, obviously Morgan Freeman has kind of gotten this reputation for playing the wise, noble guy, you know, and it was very weird seeing him in this role. And I don't know if it's just because I'm not used to seeing him that way or if it was just...
Well, you know, he has done some bad guy work in the past. I mean, he was in a movie Reed called Street Smart.
Street Smart and Easy Reader. You know, you know, it's not that. I guess maybe it was just I wasn't used to seeing him at this low quality level. I did love Lucy Liu in this. I thought she had a lot of charisma.
Exactly.
She was incredibly likable in this.
And it's like I wanted her character to kind of see Bruce Willis in action and then go, oh, I've never fallen in love with a hitman before. And then they go off into their own little world and it becomes a different movie. But just...
I got to say, I think that Bruce Willis annoyed me more in this movie than even Josh Hartnett did.
Really?
He's giving the same performance in movie after movie after movie. I miss the energetic, funny Bruce Willis we first saw in Moonlight. And It's like in every single movie he does now, it's like he tries to be as still as he can be and as somber as he can be. It's kind of like that thing Bill Murray's doing, you know, where it's bordering on, okay, we understand. I mean, it's a great performance and all. We're not used to seeing you this way. But when it's movie after movie after movie, it gets old.
Well, I can agree with that. I wish he would kind of take a comedic role every once in a while to kind of lighten up. And for a while, he started to do that earlier in his career. He would alternate between comedies, action adventure, and you know, semi-serious bad guy roles like this. But to me, I think he was the only one that got the tone of the material right. I think that if it had focused more on his character and the title character, it might have been a better movie. But just it's so scattershot, and the dialogue is some of the worst I've heard in recent memory. And I got to tell you, I sighed more times than the equivalent of a year's worth of some magazine covers, and not in a good way, okay? I mean, it's like waiting in the doctor's office kind of size.
What were your expectations going into it?
Well, my expectation. Well, look at the cast. I mean, there's your expectation right there: Kingsley, Freeman, Willis, Lou.
I guess I was already expecting it to be kind of bad because I was kind of aware of, you know, the buzz it had when it came out. So
probably more so than me.
I guess really that I was expecting it to be more annoying than it actually was. That's not a recommendation, though, necessarily.
But I will say, there are moments. I don't want to totally give it like a bullet, which is what Rolling Stone used to do for records back in the day, if it was completely worthless. I would say maybe a half a star to a star, but there are a couple of moments in this film. You mentioned Lucy Liu, terrific actress, but don't you think she was nothing more than window dressing at times here?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, it's horrible. She's so much more talented than that, but there is one moment, in addition to another moment I'll bring up here.
Windows have more personality than Josh Hartnett.
Yeah, okay. Sorry, Josh. But the part where she's in bed with Slevin and they're talking about James Bond movies. I mean, you know, who doesn't want a girlfriend as cinema savvy as that? I mean, that scene worked for me. And there's also a scene where Kingsley and Freeman are kind of talking about their particular experiences. Those two scenes basically hit home along with Bruce Willis's tone. But other than those three things, I can't really think of a single other thing to recommend this movie with. I mean, you have a commentary. We have two commentary tracks, one with the director, one with the screenwriter whose thoughts were edited in into a little Hollywoodsy track with Lucy Liu and Josh Hartnett. A complete EPK-dominated making of, which, you know, doesn't lend any kind of insight or you learn something new. Few deleted scenes. Man, I've seen enough already. I hardly even looked at them. The sound in the picture, hey, it's a relatively new piece of filmmaking. You know, enough said. If you're into this kind of thing or you think it has potential, you're going to like the way it looks and sounds. But just, I have to say, honestly, I think this is probably going to be a contender for my worst of list when we do it around Christmas time.
Hmm. I don't even think it's worthy of worst of. It's just sort of there. It never, for me, never like reached that level of bad. You forget about it 5 minutes after you watch it, sort of bad. I'm really honestly kind of surprised you hated it as much as you did. And I'm not recommending it. All I'm saying is, you know, I watched this movie and didn't suck as much as I thought it would, and that's not a recommendation. I was kind of blah on the whole thing, actually.
And on that positive note, that concludes another edition of the DVD Marquee, and we do want to thank you for joining us. Of course, if you have any comments about the show, we have a brand new email address just introduced a couple of days ago. For those of you who haven't heard, you can reach us now at thedvdmarquee@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. Also, special thanks to the Home Theater Forum, HDF Radio, and iCraveDVD.com. Visit both of those sites. Let us hear from you via email. And I guess there's nothing left to say but the words good and bye. See you next time. Hopefully with a better finale.